Congratulations, Tom Dewey. You won by a landslide today.
Well, I am Mr. Presidential Jingles. We just don't seem to have enough of them anymore. It's time for Felix Spinell, brought to us by the King County Library System. And with the vice presidential debate tonight, Felix, of course, is thinking about debates and history. And the first TV debate, of course, was Kennedy versus Nixon in 1960, TV and radio, different impressions. We all know the story. But it was 12 years before that when candidates first took to the national airwaves exclusively on radio. And Felix is here with the story of that first broadcast debate, which I didn't realize had a connection to the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, it was back in May 1948 when the Republican Party was choosing a nominee to run against Democratic President Harry Truman, and they decided to have a debate in Portland. The Republican frontrunner was New York Governor Tom Dewey. He'd lost to FDR in 1944, and he was definitely the establishment candidate. Now, Oregon held the final primary in the country that year. In the weeks before it, Dewey and the upstart candidate, Harold Stassen, former governor of Minnesota, crisscrossed the Beaver State, pressing the flesh and looking for votes. Now, Stassen challenged Dewey to a debate, and it took him a while to agree, but he finally, about a week in advance, agreed with several conditions favorable to himself. They held it at radio station KEX on Main Street in Portland. I checked. It looks like the old KEX building is still standing, if anybody wants to put up a plaque. Now, KEX was an ABC affiliate, but the debate was carried by multiple networks. It's believed about 40 million people tuned in. It's about 25% of the population in 1948. Now, there were fewer direct primaries in those days, and not all states were contested by all the candidates. So while Dewey and Stassen showed up in Oregon, other candidates didn't, like Earl Warren of California, Robert Taft, son of President William Taft. Now, Washington, we'd held our state Republican convention on the previous Saturday in Bellingham. All the delegates had pledged to Dewey. So the debate was an hour long, took place on a Monday evening. I have several cuts, and they're on the long side, but they kind of need to be to show how different the style of debating was 72 years ago. And it's not like a debate we're going to see tonight or like we saw last week. Thank goodness. No. The debate was moderated by the chair of the Multnomah Republicans, and there wasn't really any questioning. It was more of an academic-style debate with a single question, and that question was, shall the Communist Party in the United States be outlawed? The AP said this was an issue which overshadowed all others in the campaign for Oregon's 12 Republican votes. Now, each candidate had about 20 minutes to deliver prepared remarks, followed by a short rebuttal by each, and Dewey had insisted that he have the final word. Now, Harold Stassen spoke first. He took the affirmative position of outlawing the Communist Party. But he, more than Dewey, managed to work in some of his general views and positions and even a little shout-out into his little local shout-out into his opening pitch.
I've submitted to the people of Oregon my position on the building of the resources and the rapid development of the Columbia Basin and the Willamette Valley, the need for long-range programs in agriculture and forestry, and the importance of that fair balance between management and labor, and of progress in housing and health. I presented my view of a strong foreign policy for America, with alert and trained military position, the Marshall Plan, leadership toward amending and strengthening the United Nations Charter, the stopping of shipments of machine tools and electrical equipment to Russia, the direct outlawing of the communist organizations in America and in the free countries.
Of course, those darned Russians came up a lot in a debate about communism in 1948, and they keep coming up. In 1948, it's the early days of the Red Scare, with the Cold War sort of setting in and real imagined fears of communists hiding under every rock. Now, I like this next cut because of the dignified tone and tenor of how Stassen lays out his disagreement with Governor Dewey.
Governor Dewey has insisted that our present laws are adequate. I submit that a new law is needed. It should directly make it illegal after its passage to carry on any organization, either above ground or below ground, which is directed by the rulers of a foreign power for the purpose of overthrowing the government of the United States, destroying the liberties of its people, and bringing this country under the domination of the rulers of a foreign power.
There's sort of a respectfulness here we haven't seen much lately, and of course it's a primary debate, so you expect a certain cordiality between candidates of the same party. Stassen saved his tough talk for the commies.
I am confident that Governor Dewey's opposition is completely sincere, but I respectfully ask him to reconsider his opposition, as I believe he is mistaken. His position, in effect, means a soft policy toward communism, and all the evidence around the world shows that a soft policy wins neither peace, nor respect, nor improvement from the communists.
Now, if any of this makes you think of Senator Joe McCarthy, I read at least one account that said McCarthy was traveling with Stassen while he toured Oregon and was there in Portland for the debate. Now, the negative position against outlawing the Communist Party was the domain of Governor Tom Dewey, and he made it very clear how he felt.
I am unalterably, wholeheartedly, unswervingly against any scheme to write laws outlawing people because of their religious, political, social, or economic ideas. I'm against it because it's a violation of the Constitution of the United States and of the Bill of Rights, and clearly so. I'm against it because it's immoral and nothing but totalitarianism itself. I'm against it because I know from a great many years' experience in the enforcement of the law that the proposal wouldn't work. And instead, it would rapidly advance the cause of communism in the United States and all over the world.
And in this final cut, Dewey name-checks Hitler and Stalin and mentions Japanese war leaders. You know, this is just 3 years after World War II, and Stalin was still in power.
As I've watched this proposal, this easy panacea of getting rid of ideas by passing laws, I've been increasingly shocked. To outlaw the Communist Party would be recognized every place on earth as a surrender by the great United States to the methods of totalitarianism. Stripped to its naked essentials, this is nothing but the method of Hitler and Stalin. It is thought control, borrowed from the Japanese war leadership. It's an attempt to beat down ideas with a club. It's a surrender of everything we believe in.
Wow.
Are you clear on Governor Dewey's position there, Dave?
Yeah, I think so.
So Dewey was believed to have won the debate. He won the Oregon primary a few days later, and he won the Republican nomination and, of course, beat Truman to take the White House that fall, right? That false headline about Dewey defeats Truman. The debate got mixed reviews. The Oregon Journal called it the debate of Tweedledum and Tweedledee. They didn't do anything similar in 52 or 56, and it took till 1960 till it came to television. But this was the first glimpse of what a debate between two people running for an office with national implications, how that could be explored in depth for a national audience.
Yeah. Felix Bunnell, brought to us by the King County Library System. Thank you, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Someday, researchers are going to want to know exactly how this pandemic changed the way we socialize, the way we move around, the way we mask up. And a couple of researchers at the University of Washington since April have been gathering the raw data that will help that happen. Professor Joseph Wortman and Assistant Professor Nicole Errett are joining me now. So tell me exactly what it is you're collecting and how you collect it.
So we are collecting longitudinal street view surveys, very similar to Google Street View surveys. We're using the same kind of instrument. And we're doing these surveys across the broad socioeconomic cross-section of Seattle. It's a 100-mile route. We run it every 2 to 3 weeks. We started running it in early April, and we're going to continue to run that through the summer of 2021. And the objective of the project is to capture data about the state of the city during the pandemic, and then during its anticipated recovery.
So you're driving around taking pictures, and then how do you analyze all that information?
We are working on some AI algorithms to help sort the data. We collect about a terabyte of data each day. We do one of the drive through the city. So it's an enormous amount of information, too much to really sort by hand. But some of the questions we're trying to answer is, for example, mask use is a little bit easier to find just by looking at images. And so we're doing a little bit of both right now, but we're really hoping to enhance the AI algorithms to automate some of the data extraction.
You've been doing this since April. So you captured at least the first peak of the pandemic, and you're still collecting information. So have you been able, I'll ask you, Nicole, because you specialize in the public health aspect of this. Have you arrived at any insights?
So this is probably our first opportunity as a society to see the impacts of a pandemic over time. From a public health perspective, we have the opportunity to evaluate the impacts of these really restrictive non-pharmaceutical public health measures like the Stay Home, Stay Healthy order and the Governor's Safe Start program. We want to know, are people complying with social distancing guidelines? Are they using their masks? But we also want to know what happens, what are kind of the side effects of some of these policies? Are businesses reopening? Are they shutting down? Are people using parks? How are they recreating? What are people doing differently as we go through the different phases of the pandemic?
So then you can detect all that too. You can detect whether a business is open or closed, whether parks are crowded or empty, things like that?
Yeah. So that anything that you can see and detect with the human eye, we can train the machines to also detect. So we can visibly see that a business is open or a business is closed on the street.
You can. So can you give an example of how you might use this data?
There's a big drop off in traffic. There's far fewer people using public transit, and that's quite visible. We see that bus stops are empty and so forth. But we're also seeing a lot of public life in public spaces like parks, on sidewalks. And how much of that is the summer and how much of that is just the fatigue from quarantine? I don't think we've sorted that out yet. But I think a longer term outcome of this work will be to get refined models of understanding of how people are responding to some of these non-pharmaceutical interventions and how that might translate into disease transmission.
I see. So you're collecting all the data, and buried in there somewhere is the answer to whether telling people to wear masks actually made a difference, and whether sending an economic stimulus actually helped keep businesses open, things like that.
And that's really a lot of the idea behind making this data openly available to not just the research, but to the practice communities and to ordinary citizens who want to go back and see what their neighborhood looked like in March or what their mm-hmm. neighborhood looked like this summer.
And you mentioned that you can detect whether businesses are open or closed. So does this also essentially give you a snapshot of the state of the economy?
So, for example, if we're seeing a lot of small business closures and we can show that through our data, can we come up with policies or plans that would help to mitigate those small business closures based on when they happen after different policy decisions and at different times during the pandemic?
Professor Joseph Wortman and Assistant Professor Nicole Arrett, who've been documenting day by day what this community looks like so that someday researchers will use that data to demonstrate the real world consequences of the decisions we made. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Despite the growing outbreak at the University of Washington and a transmission rate believed to be above one, once again, Governor Inslee is loosening some COVID restrictions. Here's Chi Radio's Hannah Scott.
After days of controversy, concern, and no shortage of politicking over President Trump's positive test for COVID-19 and the president's comments and behavior about COVID that have come in the last couple of days, the governor got worried about the message being sent and decided to call a press conference, especially after the president took part in a photo op not wearing a mask. Governor Inslee called that press conference yesterday, leading off, though, with a local medical expert who strongly reiterated the importance of masking up and continuing to follow all the safety protocols. After the doctor made his point about the importance of not doing a photo op unmasked, Governor Inslee weighing in.
We need everybody to pitch in, including the President of the United States, to help us through this difficult challenge. And unfortunately, we're just not getting it. We didn't get it at the beginning when he downplayed this virus, when he told us it was going to go away the next Tuesday, when he refused to help us get PPE. And we're just not getting it now. And I got to tell you, it's very, very disappointing, as the doctor alluded to.
He's stressed.
You know, last night when he stood on the balcony for his photo opportunity, we know he wanted to project strength. And as I've indicated, what can project strength is to help save lives. Saving lives is what's really strong. And when he has continued to downplay the importance of masks, that's really dangerous. And I just have to tell you what's so troublesome to me. When he was standing on that balcony, you can look out towards the Washington Monument. And if you looked out there, this is what you'd see last night. 20,000 chairs around the Washington Monument. You can see that from the south balcony. And those 20,000 chairs, each one represents 10 deceased Americans killed by the COVID virus. Over 200,000 people represented by that. And how anyone could look out on the representation of 200,000 deceased Americans and belittle the threat that this virus poses, to try to tell Americans not to be concerned about this, to model dangerous behavior, that's just not performing the duties of the president to us in the state of Washington.
Then a shift in the mood and some unexpected good news.
Today we're announcing that we're allowing more school and non-school sports, both indoor and outdoors, according to the local metrics, according to the type of sports. And we have now found a way, we believe we can do this reasonably safely. We have a new rules that will allow movie theaters to open up, libraries to open up, wedding receptions to open up, real estate activities to open up, and some outdoor recreation. We'll make some changes that the cutoff for alcohol in restaurants will be advanced to 11 p.m. from 10 p.m. We are also allowing greater capacity at tables in phases 2 and 3. And we are eliminating the restriction that was in place that required you to only dine with people in your household. We're opening libraries for indoor operations in phase 2 at 25% capacity. Realtors can host open houses again.
The loosening of restrictions comes despite high case numbers and what many health officials believe might be the start of a third wave as we head into flu season and winter. So if it's safe enough to allow these activities to resume, why not finally resume allowing counties to advance to the next phase, which the governor paused several months ago?
I think increasingly the way we need to think about this is not just so much as prohibitions about what you can't do, but adaptations to show how we do something safely. And so we think we've been able, by working with the communities, to develop ways to do these things safely. And we expect that that effort will continue. So that as we've figured out a way for kids to play soccer safely, let's get them to do it. As we have figured out a ways to open up theaters, let's do it safely. And so what we're doing is taking a very targeted approach based on science, based on the business needs, and listening to the community.
And Inslee says,
we hope that's going to continue. Now, it's dependent on our ability to continue to drive these numbers down.
Bottom line?
Now, we are hopeful that the recent uptick in the numbers have been caused by one-time events, Labor Day, and perhaps the smoke, that we kept us inside more, and we think those might be one-time events. We hope they are, so we can get back on the track of knocking these numbers down again.
And Hannah joins us live. So does this come in time to save businesses that were otherwise going to close forever?
I think it's a mix. I've heard reports with some restaurant owners and bar owners who are thrilled, who think that especially the restaurant changes, which are going to be you no longer have to all be from the same household to sit. The counties that are in phase 2, I believe they can have 6 people per table, and in phase 3 you can have 8 people per table, and that seemed to give a big break to restaurants who've been pretty limited so far. And then the bars are only allowed to stay open 1 extra hour, and I've heard from bar owners who are thrilled with that. They're you know, getting some extra staff, but I know personally some bar owners who say that's nowhere near good enough. They usually stay open till 2. They've had to cut shifts. People are struggling, but it's something. So I think that it saves some. I don't know that it's going to save everybody.
Well, do you know any more about the bar rules? What is it that has suddenly made it safe? Because bars apparently are the place where it gets super dangerous, because you have a lot of people drinking, letting their guard down indoors and usually unmasked. So what makes it safe now?
Well, and all the, bars, you have to, and by state law, you have to have the mandatory face coverings. I don't know how much policing is done about that.
How do you drink with a face covering on?
Well, and that's the thing. And I've been, there's a sports bar by my house where I go watch football, and I wasn't sure what to do. And they said, if you've got a drink in front of you, you can just take it down. All the tables are 6 feet apart, like that.
Yeah.
The situation with the bars has always been, because at the beginning of the summer, younger people started getting ill, getting the COVID, and it was largely kind of blamed on being carefree and drinking too much and not being very careful about what you were doing. And then, maybe you go home or you're around someone who's very vulnerable, and it spreads and it makes it, worse for that person, that kind of a thing. That is still a very real possibility. The governor was asked about this yesterday. Why make this change again? It's just an hour later. The bars across the state were all supposed to close at 10. No alcohol after 10. Now it's no alcohol after 11. And he said, we have to trust that hopefully people are going to just be responsible. We can't stop everything, essentially. Yeah.
Now, is it true that I saw this statistic? I think it was Gene Bok's piece, where the Seattle area has one of the lowest transmission rates in the country.
Yes. So what that was the result. Early on, Mayor Durkin had asked her staff to go through and check with the 30 other large cities across the country and track what their cases were and what their rate was. And I don't have it right in front of me at the moment, but I remember it was Seattle had the lowest. There was kind of some weirdness about the methodology where they couldn't compare everything city to city. For some places, it was countywide because they didn't track things that way. But it's still, Seattle came out on top with the lowest
you know, rate per thousand people, I believe is what it was. And Seattle was doing pretty good. And I had this conversation with John and Tom on Tom and Curly yesterday afternoon. Largely, most people believe that that's because not just in Seattle, but in the state, we were hit first with COVID, and the governor was very quick about shutting everything down and has been pretty stringent about opening anything back up. So this came as a bit of a surprise yesterday. But that's, I think, why our numbers were down and perhaps why Seattle has done so well.
Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Got a new vibe for the Daily Dose of Kindness. Just for today, though.
Nice.
I know. Never gets old. Never gets old. This is sponsored by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. Who knew that in the year 2020, two things would be making a comeback? Ocean Spray Cranberry Juice and Fleetwood Mac's song Dreams. And all thanks to an unlikely TikTok star named Dogface. Now, if you're not up to date on this extremely viral video, do you know what I'm talking about yet, Dave?
No idea.
Oh, my goodness. Dogface, a.k.a. Nathan Apodaca, created a TikTok video in late September of him on a skateboard holding a large bottle of Ocean Spray Cranberry Juice, vibing to Fleetwood Mac's song Here. And eventually, he takes a swig of the juice, and then he starts lip-syncing. It is the epitome of chill. After watching this video, you wish you were as smooth as him on a skateboard drinking juice. It has more than 50 million views now, and it got a big boost last week when Mick Fleetwood himself recreated the video. A nod of appreciation and approval. So who is Dogface Nathan, the coolest guy who drinks juice? He's a 37-year-old from Idaho. He works at a potato warehouse. He's the father of two daughters, who are the ones that introduced him to TikTok. And it turns out the only reason that video was possible is because his car broke down that day.
Died out. I didn't want to get it started. Sit there and wait and flag somebody down. I don't have jumping cables myself, you know.
Right.
So I was just like, whatever, man. I don't work far from my work. I live far from my work. My longboard is always with me. Got my juice always with me. So, like, I just grabbed it, just took off.
And there's the content. It took a few days for this background story to come out. But just this week, Ocean Spray CEO Tom Hayes, he recreated the video and then paid Nathan a visit and surprised him with a brand new truck. The truck, of course, packed with juice. And Nathan, in his response, remarked, "Dreams do come true."
Yes, they do. I do love cranberry juice.
It is, yes, a thirst quencher for sure, a go-to for me as well, but it's not something I buy regularly at the grocery store, so I can imagine Ocean Spray is thankful for this fame, right?
I don't think I could imagine it while being on a skateboard, though.
Okay, I have to send you the video. It is the smoothest thing you'll ever see. His fortunes have really turned around in a two-week period. He lives in an RV parked at his brother's house, but now, you know, so much donations and money and endorsement opportunities are coming in. The thing is, he's used a lot of the recent money that's come in to buy his family things that they need. He says he feels blessed and he wants to pay it forward. The coolest guy ever. Just love it. So I'll send you that video. It's great.
Now, from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio, here is G Scott to join us in congratulating the Seattle Storm, who won the WNBA championship for the fourth time.
Was that your party whistle?
That's really good. That's his air horn.
Hey, shout out to the Seattle Storm. Mm-hmm. Those women are phenomenal. You want to talk about a sports dynasty here in this town? You will never be able to talk sports dynasty without bringing up the Seattle Storm. It is a beautiful thing. I hope young women and men are inspired to see this and are jumping up and down. It is phenomenal. Breonna Stewart, ooh, that's a bad, she's so good. 18 months ago, she ruptured her Achilles tendon. Like, I've ruptured my, Achilles tendon before. Let me tell you something. It is not fun. The recovery is not fun at all.
Your foot just, like, dangles there after you. It's so gross.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, guys, look, I haven't ran since. Anyways, that's kind of a joke. But Breonna Stewart, 18 months ago, she ruptured her Achilles tendon. And here she is 18 months later. Finals MVP, still doing it.
Oh yeah,
the resilience. I love it, guys. I'm excited for Seattle. Four titles. Can you just four titles?
Yeah.
Come on now.
Can I be cynical for a moment?
go ahead.
Because when I heard you say you won't be able to talk about Dynasty without talking about Seattle Storm, I wanted to say, and yet plenty of sports stations do, because they aren't talked about enough. I think it's changing. I think they're getting more support from the NBA, and I think more sports commentators are recognizing the dominance of this women's team. But I don't think they get the respect and the paycheck and in the attention that they deserve.
They need to get some more paycheck. You know what I'm saying? And right, that's how you really show the love. Give them more paycheck. And I know people are like, oh, well, they don't bring in the money and blah, blah, blah. Whatever.
Stop.
Stop it. Stop it. Give them a paycheck. Oh, how's the women's national soccer team doing? Right. Oh, that's right. They do really well. Okay. I know you guys didn't want to just talk sports the whole time.
Well, I'm just looking forward to the day we just go and see a sports match in person again. We've gotten some more orders from the governor on who can open and do what. The question is, will people take advantage of it? So you're sort of the barometer for this, right?
Yeah. Well,
The movie theaters, the libraries, real estate open houses, some outdoor recreation is coming out. Restaurants and bars can now serve more people and stay open later. Is this going to change where you recreate, or are you going to stay isolated?
Well, I'm going to personally my type of isolation, and I'm going to say something, because sometimes I feel like you can offend someone if you try to tell them what to do and what not to do.
Yeah.
Here's what I'll say. You know in your heart when you say to yourself, oh, you know what? I should have maybe never done it. That wasn't really safe. You know those things. So I'll give you an example. Last night, as you guys know, that I had this. I do deliveries a lot during the evening times. And last night, I went to go pick up at Buffalo Wild Wings. And I go inside of there, and I'm like, wow. Everybody's there watching the game, and it feels reminiscent of pre-pandemic.
Like, anybody in a mask?
Well, once you get to your table, Colleen, you don't have to wear a mask.
That's so crazy. It even matters when you're talking and reveling in the game. You're spewing those aerosols everywhere just because you're sitting distance from somebody at another table. You're still trapped in a building with
So let me get this straight. On the door, it says, "Hey, you wear your mask. You wear your mask when you come in this establishment." And you walk in, you're wearing your mask. Oh, table for four? Yes. Oh, yes, your family? Yep, it's just our family. We're sitting here at our table of four. And then there's another family, table of four. And then there's another table of four. And a four.
Yeah.
And then guess what? Once you get to your table, you can take down your mask. Now,
is there any plexiglass?
No, Dave. No. That's where I was going to. Now, so here's the thing. Here's what I want to say. Now, you're in that situation. I'm not going to be the one to tell you what you should or should not do.
Yeah.
I'm telling you what I'm not doing. I'm not going to be sitting at a table, because now my life is based on the four people next to me that I don't know. I don't know you. I don't know where you've been. I wouldn't go ahead and give you a kiss on the mouth. I don't know you. Therefore, I don't even want your aerosols.
And it doesn't mean you can't support businesses. So many have adapted to takeout. That's right. I probably won't be going inside restaurants anytime soon.
But I see, but that's
but
the
I
G
sure
rule.
Am doing takeout.
The G rule is, don't sit anywhere near people you wouldn't kiss.
Is that what you're saying?
I mean, right. I mean,
yeah, okay.
I kiss my family.
Yeah.
No, in the mouth.
I get it.
Yes.
G and Ursula, starting at 9 right here on Cairo Radio. Keep your kisses to yourself, people. As Seattle continues its budget battle over the future of policing, there are some new details from state lawmakers about a much larger police reform effort statewide. Here's Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
The name of the game, accountability. Sure, we passed I-940, one of the strongest police accountability laws in the nation. But a year later, as final rulemaking was wrapping up, it became clear that it lacked teeth and oversight. And already, some agencies have not followed the law. State House and Senate leaders have been working behind the scenes on dozens of proposals for police reform issues that have come to light since the world watched what happened to George Floyd. A couple of weeks ago, they were ideas. Now, many of them have taken the form of a 42-page bill that, should everything in it pass, completely reimagine police accountability.
Really looking at the whole waterfront of ideas, many of which have been considered over the last few months in other states, so that we have some indication of how those debates have gone and what the results have been in terms of trying to improve accountability.
Democratic Senator Jamie Peterson is chair of the Senate Law and Justice Committee.
Police officers, like nurses or doctors or lawyers, are allowed to be police officers because they are certified by the state's Criminal Justice Training Commission.
At the heart of the bill is the actual accountability in a proposed revamped decertification process meant to ensure that no officer with a history of bad behavior gets to keep being a cop.
The decertification process is what happens when there's been a significant violation of that trust. So somebody who has used excessive force or somebody who has lied under oath or, you know, otherwise abused the trust that we've given them as law enforcement.
Problem had been.
There are some significant problems with the process that we have in statute right now. This bill is really designed to implement best practices that we see from states around the country in terms of their willingness to deprive folks who have abused trust in that way from the ability to work in law enforcement.
Under this bill?
With unfortunate frequency, it is the case that police officers who have abused the trust then run a course of appeals that can take years during which they're still permitted to work. And if they sort of see the writing on the wall that they're going to lose at the end of that process and lose their jobs, they can resign in lieu of discipline. And that actually, under the current statute, prevents the Criminal Justice Training Commission from taking any action with respect to their certification.
And civilians will have a much larger voice in all of this part, in this accountability effort.
The Criminal Justice Training Commission to take action to decertify or to suspend or require retraining for an officer. The grounds on which they can take action are also broadened pretty substantially. And the bill, as it's, you know, in its current draft, will actually change the composition of the commission and of the individual hearing panels so that there'll be, rather than being a large majority of police officers and law enforcement professionals, it'll be made up of a majority of citizens.
And Hannah joins us live now. So this seems to get to the heart of the problem with cops who are passed from department to department without ever being held accountable.
Yes, exactly. And that's, again, that's the teeth, that's the accountability that was missing in I-940. This particular issue of decertification has been raised in the legislature once before, and it didn't make it. But it's a really, really big part of the conversation now, because there is more frequently, and I think as Senator Peterson said there, very frequently you'll see an officer, if they see the writing on the wall, right, they go, okay, they resign, because our state law allows them to just move on and they don't get disciplined. There's nobody tracking this data either. So there's no, that's going to be something that's also in this 42-page bill, where there has to be, every agency has to report the various misconduct, whatever happens to, you know, if an officer is disciplined or fired or any of that, it all has to go in one big system. And also, when we hire from out of state agencies, they're going to have to look at that and make sure we're not bringing anybody in from out of state who has that kind of record or is on a Brady list or something like that.
Now, does this strike that balance between ridding police departments of bad officers without destroying the morale of good officers?
That's the hope, definitely. I mean, a ton of work has gone into this, but it's, you know, largely Democratic lawmakers who've been involved in these discussions. Senator Peterson has been speaking to a lot of different stakeholders. He has just sent out, I think he just actually got the bill on paper on Friday, and he sent it out to the various police groups, police unions, and coming up on the 14th in the Law and Justice Committee, he's going to have a whole work session. So he's hoping to hear from them before then. And it's, you know, it's, we're not in session yet, so there'll be retooling that happens to the bill based on some of that input. But there's a lot that's gone into this, and again, over with Representative Goodman is going to do the companion bill over in the House, that they think this is going to be the right balance, because there's no, the discipline and the accountability is just not happening right now to make sure the few bad actors, and there is just a few usually, are not allowed to keep being cops.
Now, did I hear you say that there would be more citizens than police officers on this body that would evaluate the these cases?
And this might be one of the more controversial parts. This is going to be after the Criminal Justice Training Center does their thing, the actual decertification panel will be not just law enforcement people. It would be actually more civilians than law enforcement types. So the idea there is that you hear more and more, no matter what process about policing we're talking about when it comes to any kind of discipline or accountability, that the people want to have their voice. They want to be able to weigh in because it doesn't seem like anything changes otherwise. Yeah. So that's what this bill calls for. I asked him, I said, you know, anytime you ever talk about putting civilians in charge of anything that has to do with police discipline, you get the comments that, you know, they don't know. They don't have the training. They don't know what it's like to be out there on the streets. What do you say to that? And, you know, he's on the ethics board at the legislature, and he said that's what they say for everything, that this people won't know, and they're just wrong, is essentially what he believes.
And do you have any indication that this is enough to mollify the various groups that have been demonstrating every night?
I don't know. It's a good question. I think they're very hyper-focused, most of the ones that are still out on the streets right now, on, well, a few different things, but certainly hyper-focused on Seattle. Yeah. I think the King County Equity Now, your decriminalized Seattle, your Black Lives Matter, who we heard from very early on, those larger groups after George Floyd, I think absolutely that this, if this were to pass as is, you're going to see some pretty happy people. Some of them, I think King County Equity Now, I know, has been involved in these discussions as well. This really impacts a good deal of the things we've been hearing about for years. And there's much more to it, a lot more to it. And it doesn't just apply to cops either. This applies to corrections officers, reserve officers, campus security at college, public schools, all of that. Tribal cops can do the decertification process as well if they wanted to. So,
here is Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.